and welcome to the Media Matters podcast, presented by myself, Colette Sexton, news correspondent at the Sunday Business Post. In each episode, we talk to an expert in the media and marketing industry and pick their brain on the topics that matter. This month, my guest is Aoife Clark, Head of Communications at Lidl Ireland and Northern Ireland, with responsibility for public relations, events, internal communications and social media. Prior to joining Lidl in 2008, she worked as an accounts director in the sports division at Slattery Communications and as an accounts executive at the Hospitality Partnership. Welcome, Aoife, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Colette.
So you joined Lidl in 2008, and that was when the recession was just hitting. Did people change their attitudes to discount retailers then out of necessity, or do you think it was thanks to the talent of Lidl's PR team?
Well, I'd say it's probably a bit of both. It's actually, yeah, it's my 10-year anniversary next week, actually.
Wow, so, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. So it's been a phenomenal journey, I suppose, both for me professionally within Lidl, but for the company as well. I think, as I said, it's a mixture of both. I think timing was good to us. You know, the recession definitely helped. I think people's mindset changed in Ireland. Suddenly, you know, it's a bit of a badge of honour now to be that kind of savvy shopper and to be getting value. So I think it's definitely been a mix of that. I also think we've changed our company image massively over the past 10 years, I suppose, with introducing public relations to the business, which we never had before. So I think the combination of that, being able to talk about our credentials, you know, our support of like the Irish agri-food industry, you know, if that's buying Irish products here and also exporting them abroad, mixed in with talking about our leadership. And, you know, you've referenced and you've interviewed our managing director before. So I think being able to do all of that stuff has really kind of changed the public perception of Lidl.
So 10 years on, how has communications changed at Lidl?
Massively. I suppose it started in quite an isolated, siloed role. It kind of sat directly with the managing director. I suppose it didn't really progress for a couple of years. We were kind of the department that anything that was a bit left afield got landed with us, anything kind of out of the ordinary. So it took a long while to kind of, I suppose, get people to understand what it was and the benefits of doing it. I think the company wanted to do PR, they wanted to engage with media, but they really wanted to do it on their own terms, which, you know, obviously being a journalist, you know that that doesn't work. There has to be a bit of give and take. So it was definitely a struggle for a while, you know, but we kind of chipped away at it, and it's grown massively over the years. So what started as a two-person team is now still relatively small, I suppose. A lot of people wouldn't expect it. It's only 8 or 9 people at any time across each of the 4 areas that I look after. So still quite a small team, but you know, a huge amount of work being done.
And how do you work with the parent company in Germany to ensure that you're carrying their message but also getting across a uniquely Irish message, I guess?
Yeah, I suppose we're given real scope through our parent company, so, and through Lidl International. So we would call it freedom within a framework. I suppose we know the boundaries. We are a privately held company, so there's some things we're never going to be able to talk about. We don't talk about profits. We don't release company info.
Unfortunately for journalists like me.
Unfortunately, yeah. So we're limited in what we can do in that sphere. So I suppose we have to be a bit more creative in the stories that we can sell or the opportunities that we can profile. But, you know, they're very supportive. They do understand that each country has their specific, I suppose, strategy with regards to reputation and building their own brand. So I suppose once they can see clearly what we're trying to achieve, they're very supportive of what we do.
How do you juggle the various channels that you have to ensure that Lidl's message is on brand across all of them? Because they are quite vast and varied.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of coordination, I suppose, that's going on right across the business. So I suppose between marketing and communications, that's where a lot of it, I suppose, because it's the most visible through like TV, radio, press and PR and social channels as well. So I suppose a huge amount of planning goes into it. Our business year starts in March. You know, we're already, I suppose, confirmed most of our plans and campaigns for next year as much as possible. So to try and get that alignment, I suppose, from the start is really, really important to us. And it's important then that we communicate that to the rest of the business, that everyone's on board and knows what's coming down the line, and that there's no surprises for everyone. So I think it's a huge amount of internal communication, I suppose, for want of a better word, to make sure that everyone is on board, I suppose, with our strategy and where we're taking the company.
You're still very young. I know people can't see you on the podcast, but you are, I can confirm it. And you're already, you know, head of communications for a massive company like Lidl. How did you manage to get there in your career?
Yeah, I suppose I joined as in a junior role when the department was being set up. And I suppose was afforded the opportunity by Lidl to progress. So I progressed up to, I suppose, the next level. And then I was put on a development plan and I spent some time in the international office in Germany. So I initially went over there for a year, but after 6 months, the opportunity came up to move back home and lead the team. So I've been very fortunate. I think Lidl are a great company. They offer that progression. Retail doesn't suit everyone, is what I'd say. And, you know, I very often am asked a question, I suppose, in interviews and stuff, people ask what you need to be successful in Lidl. And I think you need to have a real open mind. It's a hugely fast-paced company. I know everybody says that about whatever industry or company they work in, but it really, really is. I mean, grocery retailing is probably one of the most competitive out there at the moment. You know, we're the biggest spend and stuff like that. But I suppose the company is really, really invested in giving people the opportunity. I think you get a lot of responsibility at quite a young age. Our graduate programs are really good as well. I didn't personally start on a graduate program, but a lot of people have. And they're just really open to people progressing and trying other things. So at the moment, I am in the marketing area, just keeping the seat warm, essentially, for a colleague. So it gives you a great opportunity to move across the business as well, if you're open to that. And it's just really, really, I suppose, a really great company to work for, I suppose, in terms of building your profile and building your professional career.
And while in marketing and also juggling communications, are you glad you stuck with the communications route yourself, or are you tempted into marketing now?
Well, I'm not actually looking after communications at the moment, so I've divested that to my my colleague Deirdre Ryan, who heads up the CSR area. So she's managing corporate social responsibility and communications. So I'm fully focused on marketing because it is one of the larger areas in head office. I did study marketing in college, but I've never really worked, I suppose, solely in marketing. I always went straight into that kind of PR element. So it is different. It's very, very different, I suppose. It's a lot more visual. You know, with PR, you're kind of crafting stories with words. This is a lot more visual. So I suppose I get to work on things like the leaflet that's printed every week, TV campaigns, radio campaigns, be involved in a lot more strategic planning as well. So it's really, really good. I'm really, really enjoying it. But, you know, I think ultimately my heart will always lie with PR.
Let's talk about the leaflet.
The iconic leaflet.
The iconic leaflet. So, I mean, that is, the leaflets that come in the newspapers were one of the first ways people got to know what Lidl was back in the day. And unfortunately, I know myself, many people who only bought the newspapers to get the leaflet. So how do you continue to keep that relevant now?
It's brilliant. It's such an interesting thing to see, the amount of work that goes into it on a weekly basis. It's all produced in-house, so there's a team of designers. So again, it all starts with the planning of it, liaising with the different departments. A lot of people think, I suppose, because we're working in-house, you know, as a marketing and a comms team, you know, a lot of people think in-house is the dream. But for us, it's just as challenging. It's quite similar to agency in that there's a huge amount of people who want their content in there. Mm. So obviously purchasing dominates it mostly. It is about products, but at any one time, HR might be asking, could they have ads in for recruitment? Corporate social responsibility will want to get some of their messaging in. So it's about, I suppose, sticking to the plan, the campaigns, working out what's best, I suppose, for the business, what we need to focus on. It has changed a lot over the years. You know, we've gone kind of up and down in pages. But it's something where I suppose that we're really invested in. It's something that we are known for. A lot of people ask, do we ever think we'll stop it or go digital? And I don't think we will, because it's a staple, I think, in most people's houses. Definitely, I know in my parents' house, every time I go home, it's in the same place every week.
Well, they would definitely want to be on board with it, in fairness. And I suppose it is a tangible physical product, so that is a way of getting yourself into someone's hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we print nearly 1 million leaflets a week between Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Wow.
That get distributed through all of our stores and also through some newspapers as well. So I think somebody said to me once, they think it could be the most widely published weekly content or something. So
that's a good point, actually.
And there's a huge amount of people that read it, and you know, very often we'd get calls to customer service saying it wasn't in the paper this week, you know, did something happen? So it's actually interesting to know that people do miss it when it's not there.
And how far in advance do you plan the leaflets? Like, is it something that right now you're thinking of what's going to be in the Christmas leaflet, or do you do it week to week depending on, you know, if it's a really sunny week or whatever?
No, I mean, we have to, for the amount that we're printing, we do have to print them 2 weeks in advance to mm-hmm. 3 weeks sometimes. So we can, I suppose, be caught out sometimes at various times. So again, it goes back to planning. We will sit out maybe about 8 weeks out. We plan how many pages it's going to be because we have to book in our paper with the printer. And then it's sitting down with each department. But But as I suppose we design out a flat plan of what it's going to look like, but as it gets closer to the leaflet being designed, that could change based on business needs as well. So it would start about 8 weeks out, looking at what it typically might make up, but up until it goes to print, it can change substantially.
So going from the traditional to the digital, I suppose, when Lidl launched in Ireland, social media was not even a thing really back then. Things have changed drastically since. So how important is social media now?
It's huge, I suppose. We started on social media in 2010. It was something I really advocated for. I suppose I had been an early adopter myself. I was in university in Boston, so I was one of the first people on Facebook, because our university was within the first group that was ever released to Facebook. So I knew there was a lot of potential with social media. I thought especially around the areas of recruitment and stuff, and just the way targeting could be done. So we launched in 2010 when it was our 10-year anniversary, and it's just grown massively since then. I think we're the largest supermarket retailer on Facebook in Ireland at the moment. We've got really active Twitter, Instagram and everything as well. I think what social media allows us to do, and we'd be quite strict in how we use it, it's not all about selling products. It is our company image, it's our reputation. So we don't want to talk about just what's on offer this week. We cover a lot of corporate social responsibility topics, whether it's about autism aware evenings. We do a huge amount for Ladies Gaelic Football on there as well. So we try to use it to talk more about the wider company, and not just the products that are in the store that week, because we have a lot of channels that do that, like the leaflet, like, you know, TV and radio. So it's important for us that we're able to show another side and a bit more personality, maybe on Twitter and Facebook and stuff as well.
So yeah, I mean, there is a real personality behind the social media, and like, it can be very tongue-in-cheek and very funny and kind of laugh out loud moments. How do you police that to ensure that you don't overstep it, but it is still funny and not weak jokes out there?
Yeah, I think it's quite tightly managed. It's a small team. There would be myself plus two others. So it's important that anyone new that joins the team, it's quite tightly managed with regards to how they would write tweets and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe we'll look over them before they're published and stuff like that. But once people kind of get comfortable with it, I think it flows quite naturally. We don't overthink them. There is a lot of spontaneity out there. You know, we react to things. So it is. It's just finding, I suppose, your comfort zone. It's finding your tone of voice and being comfortable with yourself as a company. And I think we've managed to blend that quite well.
And is it something that you constantly monitor, or is it like kind of a 9-to-5 job and then you come back the next day?
No, a previous boss of mine, his favourite saying was social media never sleeps, but I had to reply, well, I do. So we do, we do have to monitor it very closely. Obviously, social media, it's not a 9-to-5 job. So it's one of the more flexible parts of the business, I suppose, with regards to how our hours are worked. I just enjoy it myself personally, like scrolling through Twitter, just finding out what people are thinking or saying. So I don't really find it a chore. I think if you look at it that way, it's going to really negatively impact on you. So you really have to love it and embrace it fully in order to kind of put up with it, I suppose, because we're very, very visible. We have a huge amount of followers. We have a huge amount of engaged followers as well. So, you know, there's always people talking about something to do at Lidl. So we do have to monitor it quite closely, and we would have support in other areas of the business. Our customer service team would be very helpful as well. You know, any issues that need to be resolved, they can step in and help as well. So it's a good team effort internally.
So I've spoken to you before about the crisis management system that you guys have put in place, and it swung into action earlier this year during the Storm Emma, was it? We've had so many
storms. Emma,
now.
Yes.
During the snow where Lidl Fortunestown was basically ransacked, I suppose, for want of a better word. Would you explain to me a bit about how you've put that system in place and how it works?
Yeah, I suppose it was something that myself and JP spoke about not long after he came back to Ireland. So it's about 3 years ago. I suppose with social media, things can escalate so quickly. And that's the main challenge for us. We had noticed a few incidents of things that had happened in stores that were just being spoken about on social, shared widely. And you don't always get the time to react. People are very quick to jump to conclusions online. And if you just stall, or you don't give information back, or you don't even acknowledge, it just makes it so much worse. So we looked at the whole topic of crisis management. I was at a conference then in London and actually heard a presentation on the dreadful accident in Alton Towers and how they had dealt with the aftermath of that, where a couple of people had lost their legs because a ride got stuck. Mm-hmm. And the company that actually did the presentation, their crisis specialists. So we actually looked into them and we looked at other options. We were just really impressed by what they did. I suppose a lot of agencies that you could work with will step in when a crisis happens and advise on what you should do. But there's very few out there that will prepare you properly for a crisis.
Being proactive instead of reactive.
Yeah, being really, really proactive. So we engaged with Insignia and we've been working with them now for a couple of years. So we did a huge amount of work. I led the project with regards to setting up the crisis plan and looking at all the various elements that feed into it, what kind of support structures we could have in place, access to what type of information was needed. And then yearly we would conduct a crisis simulation. So we've done two of those to date, and everyone would be assigned roles and we'd essentially rehearse it and we do a debrief and see what worked well and what didn't work well. And then we've had to call in into action two times. So the first one was for Storm Ophelia, which was just preparing for the storm then. Obviously Storm Emma, we were like, great, we've got this, we've got it nailed, we know what we're doing, because we, you know, 6 months previously had the same thing. And obviously it took on a bigger twist then with what actually happened in Fortunestown. But I think it put us in a really good position. We were really well prepared, quite, I suppose, cohesive in our approach to communicating and our actions. And we're just so delighted, I suppose, now that the store is back up and running, and just been a really positive, I suppose. In some ways we've turned what was a really negative situation into a positive. Ruth and her store team were just absolutely blown away by the amount of support they got. There was flowers that arrived in from residents associations, there was local schools that invited the teams in as well. So you know, it's been really, really humbling, I suppose, for us as a company, but also for the team there to have that.
Is that also a sign of how the company has become part of Irish culture now?
Yeah, I think so. I think we were quite proactive in how we communicated, I suppose, in the days after it. We wanted to make it clear that the store team were going to be supported, that nobody would lose their jobs. So we had just taken a really, I suppose, generic picture when they were in for a team meeting on the Monday. So it happened on the Friday. We brought them all into the office on the Monday, just to explain that we'd redeploy them and that nobody would be out of pocket. And we put that picture up on Facebook just saying, look, we want everyone to know that the team are, you know, they're blown away, I suppose, by the well wishes from everyone. They're not going to be out of pocket, they're going to be supported. And even just seeing the comments on there, people, you know, name checking them, people also talking about their local store and what they like and what they would miss. It's been really, really positive. It's definitely not something, I suppose, that we would have seen maybe 10 years ago had it have happened. So I think it is a testament to how we even grade ourselves, I suppose, in Irish culture.
Speaking of which, the little sponsorship of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association, when did that begin?
So we've just finished our third year, so the end of the third season. So we started speaking to Ladies Gaelic Football probably about 4 years ago. I suppose we felt the time was right to engage in a high level sponsorship. We felt we'd established ourselves in Ireland, our credentials were good. We felt that that was the next step for us as a brand. So we started looking within the market to see what was available. Ladies Gaelic Football was one, and there was a couple of other options as well that we were looking at. And we had a big strategy day where we essentially kind of debated amongst a whole group of people, pros and cons for each of them. And I suppose I felt quite strongly that Ladies Gaelic Football would be a good fit for us, but I didn't want it to be seen as a token gesture or anything like that. So we very much approached it with the mentality that they're a challenger brand, a lot like ourselves, and that we could help grow their profile. Obviously the target market who we'd be targeting as well, you know, with regards to customers, would be predominantly female. So we felt that we could really kind of make some inroads there. So it all happened quite quickly. But yeah, we've reached the end of the third season with them. And we were delighted this year to extend that partnership for another 2 years as well. So we've invested over 3.5 million to date in a whole host of activities, from, you know, schools to clubs to primary school and secondary school teams. So it's been really, really positive. And again, we're blown away by, I suppose, a lot of the comments we get or letters we get from schools and clubs.
Some people say that it is one of the most successful sports sponsorships in Irish history. How did you pull it off?
I really don't know. I think very much, again, approaching it with, you know, we really want to put everything into it. it would have been so easy for us to just become a sponsor of a much higher profile sport, you know, pay out a huge sum of money, have your logo somewhere, have it on screens at every match. But that for us wasn't what we wanted to do. We wanted to make a difference. So I suppose we launched it, I suppose, in a very somewhat controversial way with the Lady Ball, I suppose, stunt, for want of a better word.
Do you want to describe Lady Ball?
Yeah, it was kind of
a
fake campaign, I suppose, fake news probably. So it was like a pink football that was designed for ladies that was, you know, softer on their hands, easier to play with. So we launched, or we had this fake company essentially launch this product. And we really went at it on social media with really like tongue-in-cheek, borderline, you know, I suppose
angered a lot of people.
Angered a lot of people. We kind of planned to make it run for about a week up until our sponsorship announcement, and after 3 days we were like, this is just, you know, it's just gone completely crazy. So we announced it after 3 days that we had done it, I suppose, to get the focus on women in sport and ladies football, and kind of turn the dial and get the conversation started. So having done that, it was really, really important that we then kind of put our money where our mouth is and launched a big campaign in support. So we have invested a huge amount of money, I suppose, in TV campaigns, billboard, print. But we've also done just as much, I suppose, at local level, because we didn't want to just take out billboards or do all that kind of flashy stuff. We really wanted to make a difference to teams. So as I said, you know, we've donated, I don't know how many kits to schools, and like equipment to clubs and bursaries and stuff like that. So it's been really, really positive for us, and you know, it was a no-brainer for us to extend the partnership. We still feel like there's a huge amount of potential. I suppose just on the back of the final there a couple of weeks ago, where they broke 50,000 for the first time, it was just incredible. And having spoken to some of the players who were there, they just said, you know, walking out into that atmosphere in Croke Park was just incredible. They've never known anything like it. So I think the future's really bright. You even saw, I suppose, on the day, huge amount of people that weren't even Dublin Cork or any of the other teams that were playing, that were just there to support, you know, ladies football and women in sport as well. So we just think it's a brilliant one to be associated with, and we're just delighted it's gone so well.
So hitting the 50,000 attendees mark was a massive accomplishment. So what are you aiming for the next couple of years of the sponsorship?
I mean, I don't think it's unrealistic to think that Croke Park would be full in a couple of years' time. There's more and more girls taking up Gaelic football. You know, more and more clubs are kind of getting buses to go up. It's a real family day out as well. It's brilliant, I suppose. We had a box in Croke Park, and last year there was only two boxes that were open on the whole box level. And we had a great box at like the halfway line on the Hogan stand. And this year our box was like all the way around the canal end because all the other boxes were open. So it's just even fantastic to see. There was a huge amount of kids there, and these are kids that would probably never get to maybe a men's final because the demand for tickets is so high, but are getting to experience Croke Park on a finals day, and they're just absolutely buzzing coming out of it. And you know, I think they're coming out really inspired. I think we've done quite a good job as well in choosing our ambassadors for the campaign. So we have one per province. So we've like Sarah Rowe in Mayo, who is just such an incredible athlete. You know, she's going off to the AFL now in Australia, which is fantastic for her, and she'll be back, you know, next year. Hopefully she's really hoping to gain as much as she can from a professional setup there and bring it back to Mayo football. And then obviously we'd have Sinead Goldrick from Dublin, who now, you know, has won two All-Irelands in a row. So there's really good girls there that are kind of great ambassadors for the support and role models for girls growing up as well.
And speaking of ambassadors, do you guys work with influencers much?
We have definitely scaled back our work with influencers. I don't think we've worked with any at all this year. It's probably one of those trends, I suppose, in the PR industry that's, in my eyes, dying a death. I think it started off as something so promising, and it's just really gone 360 now, in my mind. You know, a problem for me is like when you would approach somebody and they're, you know, to work on something or collaborate, and their first response back is, well, what's your budget? Then I just know they're just not the right fit for us. Who we do work with, and I think anyone who hates being called an influencer is probably quite genuine.
And so, I know a lot of them.
Yeah. So we work with Katrina Redmond. She runs the blog wholesome.ie, and she's somebody that I identified a couple of years ago. I just really liked her content. She's very down to earth. She's a mum based out in Balbriggan. I think she was, you know, had lost her job during the recession. So her blog was focused on creating family meals, you know, on a low budget. She lives right beside our store in Balbriggan. So I just felt she was a great ambassador for us. She does a lot of content for us. But now even she's training for the Dublin Marathon. She's competing in that in a couple of weeks.
She sounds like Superwoman.
Yeah, and she's brilliant. And it's what's so funny is anytime we'd use her in leaflets or any content, there would always be tweets of people going, I love seeing her there because she's so relatable. So I think it's trying to find people like that who have, I suppose, quite a lot of integrity. And even, you know, the first time I would have met her to discuss a longer term partnership, you know, she very much said, well, this has to be right for me. But I do love your brand and I do shop there. I genuinely shop there. You know, I don't just flip around depending on who's kind of paying me at the time. So it was really important to have that level of trust, I suppose, between us. And that's something we would look for going forward with any ambassador.
And so do you think it's more important to find someone that maybe has a smaller following but's more niche and therefore more relatable to who your customers are or might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Credibility is huge. I think gone are the days of like companies having maybe one like celebrity chef type ambassador. I think, I suppose, we'd look at our shopper profiles, you know, and we'd have a couple of profiles of different shoppers that we'd identify. So I think sometimes you need to have people that match those profiles. And there is obviously a lot of trends within the industry with regards to like clean eating and stuff like that. So it is finding people with that credibility. And sometimes I think having a smaller base of authentic fans is better than having the biggest numbers out there as well.
You're also in charge in your communications role for internal communications. How important is that? How many staff do you guys have now and across how many different outlets?
Yeah, so we have over 5,000 staff across all of our stores and warehouses in Ireland and Northern Ireland. So obviously the biggest challenge for us is the majority of those will be classed as offline, in that they don't have a company email address to communicate with. So we've had to be quite creative in how we reach out and engage with our teams on the ground. So we would have a number of different platforms. So in every store, canteen and warehouse canteen, there is a terminal with an intranet that people can access files, documents and news. But we also then developed an employee app that people could download on their personal phone. Because what we found was, I suppose, when people are on their lunch break, they don't necessarily want to be flicking through company news or seeing what's the latest. And the feedback we got was that they really wanted to have an app that they could look through in their personal time. So we launched that about 2 years ago, and it's growing every month along with subscribers. So it's a huge amount of news, and it's more news sharing. And sometimes it's kind of tips or hints on how to do things better in stores. So it's a mixture of kind of company news and stuff that will benefit them in their roles. So it's a really growing area though, internal communications. I think traditionally it would have sat in a lot of HR functions, and I think now it's kind of moving over to more of a kind of comms or marketing side, because it's more about the content, and it's not about pushing out HR messages all the time.
I know that when you did have that crisis in at the start of the year during that storm, that the first thing you did do was talk to the employees before you talked to anyone else. Is that kind of a strategy that you have put in place?
Yeah, it is, I suppose. We wouldn't want to put out a notification that stores are open or closed without teams having been told that first. So there's a number of steps we would have done, and the app would have been one of the most widely used. And actually, it's to date, it's the dates that we've had the biggest amount of hits as well, is on the days of the storm when people were logging in to check what the status was. So we would have had a policy at times of saying that the information was released. We would define certain times that app updates would go on the app, and then we would follow up with kind of, I suppose, media updates, you know, maybe 30 or 40 minutes later. So we'd allow our staff, I suppose, the opportunity to hear the news first.
We are now in the latter end of the year somehow already. It's October now, so we're going to be heading in for the Christmas season. How are you going to be preparing to market Christmas to us?
I suppose Christmas is pretty much done, so I'm probably on to like Valentine's Day or Easter at this stage. Christmas is nearly like a year-round campaign at this stage. I mean, in January you're already kind of reviewing what had happened, what you can do better. Our buying team will have bought Christmas by January of next year as well, so we'll know what kind of products are coming in. But we are in the middle of, I suppose, finalising media, you know, print delivery and stuff like that. So we decked out a store there 2 weeks ago with all our Christmas signage. So apologies to anyone in Nutgrove who got a bit of a shock. So yeah, it's Christmas is signed, sealed, delivered, I suppose, for us. So we have our biggest year ever with regards to deluxe products, which would be our kind of premium offering. So there's a huge amount of products coming in, some exciting middle aisle items as well, which I can't give away too much about yet. But I suppose Christmas is the most competitive trading time of the year. It's definitely something that requires a huge amount of planning. Unfortunately for us, we've been talking about it since February, so it's not as exciting anymore.
So it's like working in Lapland nearly, because it's Christmas all year round.
Yeah, and people often say to me, they're like, you know, do you hate Christmas? And I'm like, no, like Christmas, it's just another campaign to plan. I was like, I still get into, you know, Christmas festivities and parties. I'm not sick of it. It's now just another campaign. But, you know, we're not walking around the office in Santa costumes year round, or, you know, singing jingle bells. But it's definitely...
You've ruined that illusion for us all. And then in terms of what channels you're using at the moment for advertising, obviously newspapers are still used by the majority of the big retailers. What else is important? Are newspapers as important as they once were? Don't worry, I won't be cross at you if you say they're not. So what do you think in that regard?
I think it's finding the right mix for the message that you're selling. So there's certain things that would work better on certain channels. So I suppose for digital, there'd be kind of very highly targeted campaigns. So for example, we're looking at ski wear, which will be in November. So, you know, necessarily a print ad mightn't work for that, whereas we could do a huge amount on digital with people who are searching for ski holidays. So it's about finding, I suppose, the right channel for the message that we have. Print still plays a huge role. We have print ads every day in press. You know, they really drive, I suppose, a lot of our promotional items, things like 3 for 9 on, you know, meat and poultry. So there's a role for everything. TV and radio are equally as important to us, that it's just finding the right blend for the topic.
Excellent. Well, I think that we have covered off a lot there, Aoife, particularly since you have 2 roles at the moment. So thank you so much for coming in to have a chat to us. That's all for this installment of the Media Matters podcast. Thanks so much to Aoife Clark for taking the time to chat to me. And thanks to you all for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please share Media Matters on your social media channels, rate us on iTunes and subscribe. If you have feedback or any suggestions for future interviewees, tweet me on Colette_Sexton. Until next time.